Welcome to You Don't Know Lit. I'm Nick Argyris, and today I'm looking for the best murdery. I've murdered this sentence. That's what has happened.
As you do many. Hey, I got another one. If murdering a sentence is bad, you're a serial killer. That didn't go as well as I wanted it to.
No, it didn't.
Nope.
For anybody. I'm Nick Argyris, and I'm going to shamefully finish this sentence. Guys, today I'm looking for the best murder mystery book ever written. To help me are two likely suspects.
Oh, no.
My friends.
It's on to us.
Thank you. That's a little twist on our murder mystery theme. Ian and Joe, two high school English teachers.
Well, Nick, I don't know if I have the best murder mystery ever written, but I've got a pretty good one. My name's Joe Holshue. I'm a high school English teacher. And Nick, this week, I think you should read Drive Your Plow Over the Bones of the Dead by Olga. Wait for it. I looked up the phonetic pronunciation. Tokarczuk, Polish author and winner of the Nobel Prize in 2018. Nope. Dang, Pulitzer Prize. It did so good until then.
Full of mistakes. Maybe we should change the theme to mistake books.
Hi, I'm Dr. Ian DeYoung. I'm a high school English teacher, and I am an unusual suspect. Nick, if you're looking for a murder mystery,
Your right leg okay?
Okay. That's a bad spoilers. Movie now because it has Kevin Spacey in it. Bummer.
Yep, that's right.
Hey, Nick. If you're looking for a murder mystery, I would enthusiastically recommend The Nine Tailors by Dorothy L. Sayers because nine tailors makes a man. Are you making our sound effects in your mouth podcast. Now?
Yeah.
Yep. My gosh.
We had to cut the budget.
May your earlobes turn into assholes and shit on your shoulders.
Hey, the plot doesn't fucking matter at all. This is what I think it's about.
If you look closely enough, every author was at some point a racist.
Audiobooks don't count, right?
All art is quite useless.
Who told you that?
Fun fact, that is how Joe laughs.
Can we clear something up about that sound effect?
Yes.
Is it someone being punched?
No, it's a fire. It's like a masterpiece theater
There's
thing.
Like a thump. And I want to say it's either someone being punched or someone being hit on the head with a blunt object and falling to the floor of the library where their body will be found in the next morning.
Are you saying there is an Easter egg murder? Yeah. Oh, okay. Here we go. Let's do it. Candlestick jokes. I'm ready. I'm going to deflect your questions, Ian, and go right for what Joe said, which is candlesticks.
Suspicious.
How many candlestick murders are in your books each?
746. Wait, is that a good number? I mean, it's not true. I'm lying to you. I'm just asking if that's a good number. I'm like, are we going for more or fewer?
Wow. So I don't really have candlesticks, but I do have a lot of the clue pieces in my... What are the other ones? Ropes and guns and...
Mustard.
No.
The killer with mustard. Like teeth, like bite someone to death.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Dracula.
There is biting.
No
Dracula.
In the library. Okay.
There's many of the clue pieces. Many of the clue pieces appear in Drive Your Plow Over the Bones of the Dead by Olga.
Are there plows? Is there a plow?
Is there a plow? Surprisingly, not a plow. There are bones.
That feels like a bit of a missed opportunity, honestly. Like
it's a metaphor.
Plows are so rare in the world today. And you just if you're putting a plow in your title, are you guys familiar with the trope of Chekhov's gun?
I feel like we've talked about Chekhov's gun. Yeah, go
Maybe
ahead.
We have. So basically the idea is this is an idea related to
Chekhov with the gun in the library.
Yes, exactly. Well, actually, this is an idea related to theater, but also like narrative in general. If you introduce, basically the idea is if you introduce a gun into a play, the gun has to be fired at some point. Mm. So I kind of feel like this plow thing is a Chekhov's gun that has not gone off. Like she puts the plow in the title.
Right.
And if you include a plow, you ought to have someone plowing or something.
Sure. Well, maybe the sequel. Right, the sequel of this whodunit murder mystery that she wrote, and not only is Chekhov's gun like if you show the gun, it has to go off, but I think it also is saying that if something happens in the end, it has to be appropriately foreshadowed.
I mean, by back formation, definitely. It's and that's a super aggravating thing when something the sort of neat wrap up.
Yeah.
Where so, Ian.
Hey, yeah.
Not to get too far ahead, but I am seeing that your book is only 350 pages. So that's like, are you saying two candlestick murders per page? That is jam-packed.
I'm sure digging myself deeper into this grave, but yeah, I'm lying. I'm telling you guys up front that this is a lie.
Yeah.
There are zero candlestick murders, but for the sake of this lie, yes, I will go ahead and dig myself. And on average, there are about four in the first seven pages, and that really picks
up
the pace.
Okay, so it's not consistent.
Oh, sure. No. Well, because then it becomes predictable. You don't want predictability.
Yeah. Right. There's one page that has like seven or 12. Yeah, seven or eight candlestick murders.
Seven or 20. Hey guys, yeah, what would you say is the cardinal sin or the cardinal error of a mystery story? Like, what's the worst thing a mystery story can do?
I'll go. Joe, you go first and then I'll go.
Okay.
Same at the same time. We'll see if you say the same one.
Oh, wait, nobody wants.
I don't have anything.
It's just audio.
It's just hard to sync. I think the worst thing that can happen is I think the killer is too predictable. Too predictable.
Hmm. Interesting. So like you see through it from the jump,
right.
Basically?
Right away. Like it's like a Law and Order episode, right? Like
your side note, it's incredibly annoying to like watch a movie or listen to a book, I guess, with someone who likes predicting those spoilers and then also is really good at it.
Oh, sorry. I do this.
No, Nick.
I can see
Nick,
that.
Nick, can you spoil the end of this episode? Can you predict
Joe will win?
Oh, fantastic. Eat it, Ian.
Spoilers. Suck it, Ian. You just got murdered. I'm going to say anything related to a butler. If it's in a house and there's a butler, I'm already really upset. That's the Knives Out. I thought it was like fun if you're intoxicated or something, but like it's not really, like there was too many butler situations going on.
Too many butlers.
Like I don't want to be in a house. I don't want to. Yeah.
What if there was, but what if there was like a house and it was a butler convention or a butler party, like a bunch of butlers rented it out.
Oh, yes. Fantastic.
Do you think I was thinking that maybe for this podcast, we could all write a book together.
I would love
it. It's pretty ambitious.
It would be the worst book on record.
Maybe we could do like chapters, like I'll write a chapter of the same narrative, but I'll write a chapter and then I'll hand it off and then Ian will write a chapter, etc.
I feel like it would be like this extended game of telephone. Do you know how there's always that one kid in telephone that intentionally messes up the message? That would be Nick after
that
Ian
would be
and
me.
My chapters.
Obviously, everybody knows that's me. My chapters would just be guessing who the murderer is.
The worst.
I think what Ian meant here is...
We've kind of seen this in the... recent revelations about the Star Wars, the third trilogy, Star Wars trilogy, where it was like it's come out that the first director clearly set some stuff up, and then Rian Johnson was like, "Nope, I'm doing this different thing," and then the third director, J.J. Abrams, I think, was like, "No, we're going back to my thing."
I'm gonna do it anyway.
Nick would wrench the story way off track, and I'd be like, "Meanwhile, back at the story we were telling a minute ago."
Yeah. Meanwhile, back in fucking reality.
We joke, guys. I'm in.
I'm in too. You guys, this reminds me of we're talking about this writing a novel together thing. This is like everything. This is already being done. An acquaintance of mine, Luke Harrington, who recently published a comedy book, he's an author,
like
and one of his friends is an author too. They're colleagues and stuff. They have something called Project Co-Narrative, where they're co-writing a novel together live on the internet. So it's like
on a Google Doc.
I'm not certain.
okay.
But they do in the about the project part of their website, they do say, we'll most likely murder each other before we're done. So I guess that's on brand. That's on topic for today's episode.
I think our first co-book should be about a butler convention, a murder mystery at a butler convention. Okay, I think that sounds fucking great.
Now let's pump the brakes here, because just to walk this strand back, I made this frankly incredible suggestion and you immediately jumped on, let's co-write a book together. It sounds like you want to steal this idea and get part of the credit for it. And I'm not here for it.
I feel like we've collaborated into something beautiful.
I'd also like to point out that Nick immediately jumped to the fact that we're going to write a murder mystery together. And while I'm very excited for this week's theme, we've never talked about murder mysteries before, nor have I before this week ever read a murder mystery. So Joe, I'm not sure. I'm not sure if we're the best people for this.
You might be the most qualified. Actually, Joe's chapters are going to be like, and then it was the butler.
Guys, just tell us the butler.
He doesn't know any of the tropes. I really don't, like, as you all know, we don't really get into personal stuff at all or share our feelings or anything like this, but I'm really curious. I have a question about you and this lack of murder mysteries. And the question is, how dare you? How did you get to this point in your life?
Where do you get off, Joe?
Yeah. So when I think of murder mysteries, I think of like the classic, like detective noir novel, which I think is pretty much what Ian brought this week, right? Like this, like, is there a detective?
Yes, there is a sleuth, yes.
Like, I expect, when I think of murder mysteries, I think of books that end with everybody gathered in the parlor, like, and like a grand reveal, right? I guess I don't know, A, if that's a thing. I assume it is,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, definitely.
It's a trope.
Oh, I have a grand reveal figured out for a book.
For a book?
There's going to be like, yeah, at the butler convention, there's like a... Like, there's
don't
gotta
tell them!
No, it's fine. It's just the premise.
Got it.
Not a spoiler.
We're just, the reveal is part of the premise.
Instead of a butler convention, how about it's a butler competition?
To the death.
And the grand reveal is at the Butler Awards. It's at the Butler Competition Awards.
Very
it's
good.
Like the big showdown.
Very good. What do we call it? We call it Too Many Butlers?
Yeah, I'm going to name a character and then you guys name a character that'll be in it. Okay, I'm just going to, off the top of my head, one of the main characters, Jeeves. Okay, you guys go.
Winston.
Blanchekin McIvers. You guys are numbskulls.
Blanchekin?
First of all, you need to have a first name that sounds like a last name and a last name that also sounds like a last name. Second of all, you need to have two names.
Blanchekin.
Yeah, so Winston Winthrop.
Oh, that sounds like, okay, maybe. I'll allow it. Well, watch yourself. What's Jeeves' first name? Nick.
Oh, because Jeeves would be his last name.
Or I don't know. Maybe Jeeves is his first name.
Jersey Jeeves.
Jeff Jersey Jeeves.
Jeff Jersey Jeeves.
Well, Jersey's a nickname, obviously.
Jeff Jersey Jeeves stars in Too Many Butlers.
Mm-hmm. I have a question. Is buttle, like to buttle? Ooh, is that a verb? Yes. Like, does a butler buttle?
Yes, it is.
I've got an answer for this, as a matter of fact, and I will now pronounce the answer. Are you guys ready for the answer? Mm-hmm. Jeeves. So the character Jeeves is from P.G. Woodhouse's excellent series of farce novels.
And Jeeves novels.
And he solves problems and he's great. It's wonderful. I'm going to bring some Woodhouse sometime. But it's not a verb, but by back formation, which is where you take an existing word and you can like force it to produce a verb. Woodhouse uses this verb as an activity that Jeeves does. So one of the things that Jeeves does is buttling, and he buttles at various points in the story. But
so boring.
So would buttling be like an umbrella that butler activities fall under? So like if you're polishing the silver, is that like a buttle activity? Is that like you buttling, or is it totally separate than answering the door and polishing silver?
Like, would the action be, can you please go buttle the door?
No.
Can you buttle this silver?
I'm just picturing a man in tails rubbing his ass up against the front door.
Wait, where did that come from?
Can you buttle this door?
Oh, no. I hate that so much. Oh, miserable.
Oh. I think we should dedicate a portion of this show to discuss our book every week. Before we move on, let's just cover the show rules and get your 30-second plots so we can actually talk about the books that people might be wanting to actually hear about.
The reason people paid for this podcast.
Our co-book fiction. For the show rules here, let's not forget them. Only unavoidable spoilers. Omit needless words, Joe. And winning isn't everything. It's the only thing.
It's the only thing. It's the only thing.
So I got a question regarding spoilers.
Oh my God. Yeah.
In preparation for today's episode, as you guys know,
the relevant rule.
I'm the most conscientious of all of us about spoilers. I never give spoilers. Yes. You know this about me. But I was especially conscientious this week, and I'll go ahead and say I only have like barely two spoilers. How do we treat spoilers? Like, we really can't do spoilers, like hardcore, right?
Try to avoid them.
Okay.
I would say only unavoidable spoilers.
Are they unavoidable? And not like you're driving down the road and you see a cat and you don't really have to swerve. Like, are they truly unavoidable?
What's this now?
What is the question? I don't know. Just avoid them, Ian.
Okay.
If you have to, I guess.
I'm not going to spoil anything.
Do me this favor. Ian, just avoid them, please. Please avoid them. Nobody wants to know who the murderer is, or I will bleep you. So let's get going. Joe.
Yes.
You're good, but Ian's time has already started for his plot, so get going.
It is winter in the English fen country. The church bells toll. The fog rolls in over the dark waters of slow-moving canals. A man's mutilated, rotten body is found dead in someone else's grave. Who is he? Who killed him? And why is he wearing French underpants? You have to read The Nine Tailors by Dorothy L. Sayers to find out.
That's what are good. French underpants?
Oh, I just told you, Joe, you have to read The Nine Tailors by Dorothy L. Sayers to find
it's
out.
Like, he's not even listening, Ian.
Litheads, if you came here for the lowdown on French underpants, I got nothing for you. I'm sorry.
But it's naughty. All right. Go, Joe.
Nick, this book is weird. Is it a noir novel? Is it a Is it magical realism? Is it a feminist revenge story? It is a whodunit that has been praised as a literary masterwork. It follows its 60-something narrator in all of her Mirandarian thoughts. She's obsessed with horoscopes, animals, and keeping an eye on the homes that she cares for in the small Polish vacation town she lives in. It is through her eyes that we watch the body count in this novel rise.
I'm actually going to give you more than 30 seconds right now, Joe, just because I want to hear the name of the fucking book.
in the book, I don't think Ian said his. Did Ian say his?
I did.
Did. And the author,
it's all
when
packed
it was
into
written,
my last sentence,
the page
which Joe
count.
Just selectively tuned out of.
All right. Yeah. I was thinking of what I was going to say. In Drive Your Plow Over the Bones of the Dead by Olga Tokarczuk.
That's time. Good job.
Amazing how that works.
A tight 30. All right.
Drive your bones over the plows in the bed.
Drive your plow over the bones of the dead.
Because I have such a taste for Joe's book, he's left me wanting more. I think I'm gonna say Joe should go first today. Joe.
Yes.
Get busy.
All right.
Tell us about your book. Tell us about The Nine Tailors. What's your book?
Oh, no. My book is Drive Your Plow Over the Bones of the Dead by Olga Tokarczuk. And this book, like I said, Nick, is a little bit peculiar. It's one of the stranger books that I've read probably for this show. A little bit about the author, first of all, because I think the book itself has a surprising history.
Let's call her OT.
There are two rookie moves, Joe. I see in your work here today. First of all, you brought a book whose title is already like 10 seconds long. Second,
this is a finite podcast, Joe. You're taking up huge real estate with this title.
I would like to point out that I was talking to my wife, and the whole time I was reading this book, I was having a really hard time remembering what the title was. So every time she would ask me, I would like mutilate it in some way. And then I finally got it down and I finally got
it
right.
You would murder it?
Yeah, I would murder it. And then she asked me who wrote it and I could not say the name of it. And she looked at me dead serious and she's like, baby, you got to figure out how to say that fucking name because Ian would know how to do it. That pretentious ass. Oh no, you're right. So
she is right though.
So I have here in phonetic spelling, Olga Tokarczuk, Drive Your Plow Over the Bones of the Dead. And the book itself has an interesting history. Written in Polish. Olga is Polish. Written in Polish and received to acclaim. in her native land of Poland.
Fantastic.
It was not published in English until 10 years nearly after its release. So it was written in Polish initially.
When was it released?
Published in 2009. And it was released in the United States in its English translation in 2018.
This is a fresh book for the U.S. market.
This is a pretty new book. In the meantime, Olga Tokarczuk had come to some international fame. She had been nominated for the Man Booker Prize for a book of hers called Flight. And after publishing this novel, just 2 months later, she won the Pulitzer Prize for Literature, which was kind of a big deal, especially because this is a whodunit, which is this genre of literature that we don't usually think of as particularly literary.
Mm-hmm.
Did she win a Pulitzer Prize for this book or for writing?
You
said that very strangely.
Yeah, so really tricky question. When I initially saw that she won a Pulitzer Prize right after publishing this novel, I had assumed it was for this novel, but I don't believe it is. I believe it was.
I guess that's my question. Do you win a Pulitzer Prize, writing Pulitzer Prize for a specific writing or as
you're
a,
wrong?
As a,
it's
as a
the
writer?
Nobel. It's the Nobel.
What did we just say?
Oh, I think I said Pulitzer.
It was the Nobel Prize. Yep.
This is awkward.
She did win the Nobel Prize.
Let's retcon this.
Oh, my God.
Let's retcon this.
So I'm thinking all the way back to the intro when I introduced it to Semester. Oh, my God. Guys, do we have to start over?
Give me clean audio on Nobel. Just say Nobel. Say it 10 times in a row in different
tones. Nobel. 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 Nobel Prize. Nobel. She definitely won the Nobel Prize. She has never won a Pulitzer. Not the Pulitzer.
Oh, dang. She was also, I'm sorry. I'm going to stop because I got, there's so many wonderful things about her.
There's so many wonderful things about her. Yes.
This is a productive episode.
We're learning a lot.
Okay. So here's the thing about the Nobel. You do win the Nobel for a whole like body of work. So when people win the Nobel, it's like, we saw this with Ernest, our good friend, Ernie Hems.
Ern Hemingway's case, we thought you were going to die and we realized what the world would be like without you. So here's a prize. We really appreciate you being around. She won the Nobel Prize for Literature the same year that this was published in English. Yeah, very interesting.
I like that the translator is also noted as the like almost co-author.
Well, I guess maybe you're familiar with this, but translation is a big deal. Like
it's clutch.
It's a big deal.
Because I could translate, but it would be quite lost.
Well, especially when you're dealing with a book that's really artistically written. Like it's one thing if you're dealing with something that's very kind of like very bare bones, very straightforward. But a lot of times when you're dealing with like literature, poetry, especially drama, but other things too, if the like for instance in her case, if her Polish has a particular like voice and you're translating it, you want to do a good job translating that voice. Otherwise, it'll be like you'll get the story, but you won't get the vibes of it.
So, Joe, you've never read a murder mystery. Why should I even believe that this is a good book?
That's
you don't
a great
even know
question.
What you're talking
That's
about.
A really good question. It's a good question. Hey, guys,
know,
I'm going to be
know
straight
shit.
Up with you.
You haven't even read.
Yep. Nick, can you name a murder mystery that I haven't read?
Sherlock
this?
Holmes.
Okay. Well. I've seen the show with Benedict Cumberbatch.
Technically, Sherlock Holmes is a character, not a book, but okay.
It's a series of books, Ian. Suck it.
It's like the fourth time we've said suck it today.
Well, really you can go ahead and suck it too.
Nick's really dialing in the hostility today.
So Nick, I'm gonna be straight up with you, Nick. There might be better murder mysteries.
As opposed to previously. Than
this. There might be better murder mysteries than this. I don't know. This is the one that I've read. It's the one that I've brought. I liked it quite a bit.
Joe, that type of honesty is rewarded on this show, okay? Right. You double won this episode already.
Oh, my God.
Unbelievable. Suck that.
So, just a little bit more about the author. The author is like a kind of a divisive figure. She's controversial
divisive.
In Poland. Divisive, thank you. She's controversial in Poland. She is this kind of dreadlocked vegetarian feminist. She lives with her translator and partner and their dogs in this lower part of Poland that became only became part of Poland after the Second World War. She published a book in 2014 called The Book of Jacob, after which she gave an interview and she was denounced as a traitor for suggesting that Poland wasn't just a brave survivor of centuries of oppression, but had done a fair amount of oppressing itself at times. For a while, her publisher had to hire bodyguards for her.
Okay, keep going. What happens in this book? What's this book about? What's the premise of this book?
Yeah, so in this book, there is a reclusive 60-something caretaker for a property of an older Polish woman. And she is this kind of like quirky, eccentric, sometimes even batty woman who is living in this dead of winter Polish town that is a vacation town for wealthy citizens. Her job there is to kind of patrol the properties and look after them when these wealthy citizens are out of town. One night, she's doing her rounds, and her neighbor, one of the only few people that live in this vacation town in the winter, comes out and says, "Hey, this other neighbor that we have, this guy named Bigfoot, has died." And they
is
go
it the real Bigfoot or
it is not the real Bigfoot. Hey, Nick, that's a great question. I wondered the same thing.
Because this book would take a wild turn.
In like chapter one. It's like, and then Bigfoot was there. So Bigfoot
and this woman.
Yep. So this neighbor has died, and he died in this kind of innocuous way. He choked. He was hunting in the land. He was hunting in the forest nearby, poached a deer, cooked the venison, and he choked on a deer bone in his own home.
So it starts off very exciting.
Divine intervention or.
Yeah. So she gets this idea in her head. And she thinks it's kind of strange because she notices that there's a couple of deer outside the house watching it. And she gets this idea in her head that the animals have gotten their revenge on Bigfoot for his poaching. And somehow the deer were involved in his murder. And that's obviously crazy. Like that obviously like couldn't have happened, right?
Well, I mean, deer are vicious.
Like, very vengeful in the animal kingdom.
So that obviously couldn't have happened. But then, as the novel goes on, more and more people start to die under these increasingly mysterious circumstances, almost all of them affiliated with some animal connection or another. Mm-hmm. So, for example, at a certain point, the owner of a local fox farm, a furrier, this owner of the fox farm, this furry. He turns up dead, covered with these beetles in the woods. Another guy turns up dead, and there's all sorts of like deer footprints around him. Like there's nothing at the scene of the murder except like tons of deer footprints. And it's like kind of this little dip into magical realism because as the reader, you really don't know what's going on. And
it could be deer.
like as the reader, like that's kind of the solution that you're left with after a little while is you're like, well, shit, I think the deer are killing people here.
You know what I think? As we talk about this, because I don't want to talk about what happens at all.
Sure. Yep.
This is really hard to ask you questions.
Yeah.
Well, so I got a question. Sorry.
Can I read a one-star review to help drive this point home?
Love it.
Okay. This one-star review comes from our friend Burton.
Oh, Burton. Friend of the show.
Yeah, Burton? Friend of the show, Burton.
Okay. I made it 50% and I don't know what this book is about and I don't care to read anything more about the main character. Honestly, I'm pretty sure I picked up this book because I like the title. All right, so here's the point. I can't start a murder mystery book without finishing it because what if it gets really good? What if there's like the greatest twist ever?
Okay. So,
Joe, remembering rule number one.
Yes. Is there the greatest twist ever?
Yeah. Without giving anything away. Look, because I give any book, you know, especially if it's like a mystery, a whodunit, if it's a book, a movie, whatever, even if it's slow, if it has the potential to turn out to be something super fucking cool, I'm in. I'll finish. I'll do the due diligence. Does this book pay off?
So I'm going to go ahead and assume, keep in mind, this is my first murder mystery. I've seen Law and Order on TV. I've seen Sherlock. I'm going to go ahead and assume that a twist is kind of the style of murder mysteries.
Explain the most basic terminology.
Now what is a twist, Joe?
Well, it's a garnish that you put in a drink that you drink usually.
Put in a sound effect right here, something like a ba-dum-bum-tee, you know, something like that.
And I will mark a second comedy point for myself.
You were not given a comedy point.
You can't give yourself comedy points.
We very clearly point out when it happens.
Joe, take that last point away, please.
It is crossed out. Thank you. Okay. All right. Yeah, I mean, is there a twist in this novel? Is that what you're asking me?
Isn't saying
there's a twist like a spoiler?
No, dummy.
No, I don't
think the payoff, does it pay off? Is it good? Does it have a good ending?
Okay.
Let me can I like fine tune that question a little
bit? Yes, thank you.
I don't see what need, but you can try.
Well, just the phrase payoff. Like, you invest time in this book. Is it worth the time that you invest in it and your attention?
Let me rephrase that even just a little bit more.
Please do.
Is it worth a time and investment? I forgot what you said. Sorry, I couldn't finish the joke.
Guys, let me paraphrase what you're saying. Is it worth the time? Does this book, like, if you're going to spend 9 hours listening to this on audiobook or a weekend reading this book, is it worth it?
Yep.
I would say absolutely. Absolutely, this book is worth it.
Okay, well, thank you for your time.
You heard
it
here first, folks.
So, Nick, in my extensive research for this, I came across something called the 10 Commandments of Detective Fiction. And the 10 Commandments of Detective Fiction were proposed in the golden age of detective fiction, which, from what I can tell, is like the 1920s and 30s. Ian, can you help me?
Of course.
I would, I guess. 20s, 30s, 40s, maybe.
Okay. And what this guy did is he set out a list of commandments, and he said, look, for a detective story to be good and satisfying, it needs to follow these rules.
The butler does it.
That's actually rule number 8. The butler
must include a butler.
So, rule number 1, Nick, I think you'll understand these. I'll just buzz through them quickly.
Wait, we don't get to guess?
Oh, do you want to guess? Nick?
Yeah.
Okay. Ian, would you like to guess?
Ian,
as well?
Go for it.
Are we just guessing out of nowhere? Like, what are some commandments?
Okay. Yeah, what are the rules? Yeah.
Okay. The detective has to be able to like have a logical shot at solving the problem. Not, he can't be like aided by, you know, supernatural stuff.
Awesome. So, Ian, one of the commandments is all supernatural or preternatural agencies are ruled out as a matter of course.
All right.
Ian, I'm going to give you a second point because I'm going to say that you also touched on the fact that the reader has to have all of the same information as the detective in this.
All right.
Good job, Ian. That's 2 for 1.
2 for 1. 2 for. I got 2 for.
All right. I'm going to try to get like 4 or 5 in my.
Just start talking now.
All right. I'm going to say that there's got to be a twist at the end.
Oh no.
Something about a twist? Anything about a garnish
now,
in there?
Joe, you were generous to me, so be generous to Nick too.
Did I get Nick, 4 or 5?
I'm going to say, Nick, I'm gonna give you
how many dozen did I get?
I'm gonna give you the first, which is that the criminal must be someone mentioned early in an early part of the story, but must not be anyone who the thoughts the reader has been allowed to follow. So we must be aware of the criminal.
Very generous.
It was pretty generous.
Very incredibly generous. All right, Ian, do you have any more guesses?
You've gotten 3 out of 10.
Boy. 30%.
Take the last 10. Take the last 7. Ian.
I don't know.
Let me help. Okay, I have a question for you, Joe.
Yes.
And anything about butlers?
So I'm not seeing any butlers. I do see there is one.
What about
rule,
like servants or servitude or budding, butlering?
There is one that says the stupid friend of the detective, the Watson, must not conceal any thoughts which pass through his mind. His intelligence must be slightly, but very slightly, below that of the average reader.
I don't like these commandments. They're kind of the worst. I dislike them.
Okay, go through the rest
of them.
There's
a really, really good Agatha Christie novel where you discover at the end that the main character whose like perspective you've been following was the murderer, and it's like the best ever. It's an amazing twist.
Spoilers! Jeez!
Agatha Christie novel.
I didn't tell you which one it was.
So, not more than one secret room or passage is allowable. So you guys can have a secret room, but just one of them. No hitherto undiscovered poisons may be used, and it must not require a long elaboration at the end, like a long scientific explanation at the end. It has to be accessible to the reader. No accident must ever help the detective. He must never have any unaccountable intuition.
Our book has to break all of these rules specifically.
I don't like this.
Explicit rule breaking.
The detective himself must not commit the crime. I like that one. I think that's a good one. Twin brothers.
That'd be lame.
Twin brothers and doubles generally must not appear unless we have been Chekhov'd gun for them, unless we have been duly prepared for them.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, no Chinaman must figure in the story. These are from 1920.
What the fuck just happened? Wow.
Nick, you were looking for a twist ending. Hey, that was the twist ending right there.
That was the twist. Okay, so I didn't know that a total fucking asshole wrote these rules.
All authors are eventually revealed as racist. I think I've heard that somewhere.
Who wrote these?
A guy named Jersey James.
It was the butler.
So, Nick, I think one of the things that's interesting about this story is it has a pretty unreliable narrator. So this woman that's we're following around, she's kind of likable and she's quirky, but she's also like, we're also always getting the world through her point of view. And for example, she's the type of person that puts a tremendous amount of weight in astrology. Like, she starts explaining these people's deaths by talking about, you know, the stage that Jupiter is in the sky, right? And again, through her point of view, because she's our lens into this world, she has this twisted logic that really makes sense, right? And but as a reader, it's kind of a disorienting effect because, you know, like, kind of looking at these rules of murder mysteries, you know that that can't be the actual answer. But boy, it kind of seems like the answer while you're reading it.
Okay.
So it seems like it's breaking that rule about no supernatural, preternatural stuff.
Yeah, this book reads as like magical realism at points, right? Like, it does seem like supernatural forces are at work. It does seem like there's preternatural forces at work.
Bummer.
Why is that a bummer?
Well, because I'm guessing it's not, right?
I was trying to not ask about that because clearly it's probably not. Psych, it was the deer. They have thumbs. Secret thumbs. All deers have secret thumbs.
Do they like pop out of their hooves? Deer?
They're retractable.
They're not hooves. The hooves are gloves.
What?
Over the thumbs. What? They're mittens. The hooves are mittens.
Yeah. It's cold.
No, they'd be gloves because like they're cleft, right? How many digits does a deer have?
Two.
Just two. So one is like a secret thumb and the other's just like a finger? A middle finger, probably.
Mittens,
like
a mitten.
Yeah, it's like a mitten.
Okay. Thank you. I'm all on the same page with you guys now.
Ian, have you ever worn mittens?
I hate mittens.
Because it's like that.
I despise mittens. I much prefer gloves.
Yeah, mittens are the worst. It's impossible to wear mittens and not look like a fucking idiot.
like a child. I guess like a toddler.
Like an infant. Like, oh, well, yeah, let me just hold this cocoa.
This week we're alienating our mitten-wearing fans.
There's a mitten fest in Milwaukee. I hate it.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Long lines and you can't hold anything properly.
Story of my life.
Joe, so, why should I read this book?
Yeah. The very last thing I would say about this book is I think it's the act of reading a literary murder mystery is kind of this bizarre experience in a lot of ways. And Olga Tokarczuk, she talks about, like, it's, she has a lot of these philosophical insights and asides from her main character, because we spend the entire novel inside this main character's head. So we think about what the main character thinks about. We see what the main character sees, and she has a different perspective on the world. You know, this is a 60 something Polish woman living on the border of the Czech Republic in the novel. And, you know, for 250 pages, for 300 pages, you get to feel what it's like to be a 60-something, slightly batty Polish woman living on the border of the Czech Republic, who is, like, super marginalized. Nobody takes you very seriously. She has these theories about who the murderer is. Granted, the theories are a little bizarre, right? But sound, that she's given to the police, and the police aren't listening to her. She is not taken seriously, and she is really this... in a lot of ways, a frustrating character to spend time with, but also, like, kind of, it's interesting to get insights into her thoughts in this.
Is this, okay, here's a good question for both of you.
Yep.
Is there any literary merit to murder mystery books?
Or oh, heck yeah.
Is there?
Yeah, well, I'm going to talk about that.
Or is it just finding out the plot?
Yeah, so this is what I would say about mine. You know, I always think about, when I think a movie's really good, or when I think a book is really good, it's something that you just keep coming back to in your mind over and over and over again.
Knives Out.
And, okay. And maybe. I thought reading this book, like...
You're just saying that because you can't think of any other, like, mystery detective film.
Clue. Suck it.
No.
I don't think that's a
board game
often.
Adaptation.
What are you? It's a murder mystery.
No, it's not. It's an adaptation.
And we cut Joe off.
It has a bunch of different endings. It's got all the different endings. Remember that?
I never actually saw it.
Oh, you should see it. I think there's a bunch of, it's like kind of a choose your own adventure at the end. Like they filmed like 9 different endings, and I think released them like in different theaters. So like people that saw the movie Clue would get a different ending to the movie Clue.
Who done it?
Yeah. So one of the things that I think is worth reading about this book is I think the narrator is going to stick with me for a long time, right? Like when I think about this book, I think about her thoughts on the environment. I think about her thoughts on like the border between Czech Republic and Poland. I think of her thoughts on nationalism and like male aggression, and really kind of these like pretty progressive, feminist, almost like eco. It's not even eco-friendly. It's almost like eco-terrorism-like thoughts. And I don't know. I think they'll stick with me. And I think like you not only get all that stuff in this kind of pleasant book to revisit in your mind, but you also get like a pretty great murder mystery with a satisfying conclusion and like a really like dyed to the bones whodunit.
Hey guys, I haven't been outside since March. Do you have any books about the Grand Dwarfs?
I do. I would like to talk, if we're going to do an episode focused on the Grand Outdoors, I'd like to talk about Desert Solitaire by Edward Abbey.
Is that like a card, like an instructional card game book?
Yeah, it's about 800 pages, and it's like a move by move to like open the deck of cards this way.
Yeah.
And it tells you how to play solitaire in the desert. It's very, very riveting. But you're doing it outside, so technically great outdoors.
Joe, do you have any card game tips?
I don't have any card game tips, but I do have a brief instructional... I don't have any card game tips, but I do have a brief instructional... I can't say that fucking word. Instructional.
This is all staying in, by the way.
Instructional.
I do have a brief instructional manual on taking a walk in the woods. It is called A Walk in the Woods by travel writer Bill Bryson.
Brilliant creativity.
I think you mean Billiant, because his name is Bill.
Bill. Billiant.
Billiant.
I'm sorry, let's re-record that. I think you mean Billiant creativity. Good catch, Ian.
Thank you.
Now, the Butler County Tourism Convention. Oh, can it be a Butler Convention at Butler
Absolutely.
County, Pennsylvania?
Butler University.
Of course, obviously.
What if it's like Harry Potter, but at Butler School, and he solves murder mysteries
Hang
as
on.
The Butler?
Do you think, Nick, do you believe in your heart of hearts that butling is magic?
I believe that in their DNA as butlers, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In the butler DNA, there is no one greater who is more prone to solving murder mysteries than butlers. And I just believe that that has got to start at a young age. And I feel like maybe...
I do think it's a calling.
Like Harry Potter.
Yeah, I think butlers and wizards have a lot in common. Like, I think it runs in the family. I think it's the same sort of thing.
You guys are saying that, like, you guys are saying it's DNA, and then you're saying it starts from a young age. Like, are they born or are they made? Can you be trained to be a butler? Or is there a special butler sorting hat that tells you where to go?
Well, yeah, there's a sorting hat, but it's also in their bones. And I think that people want to see a young butler solving crimes.
Some men are born butlers and others have buttledom.
I got it. Give me a second. Yep. Give me a second. Some are born butlers. Some achieve buttleness, and some have buttleness thrust upon them. Yep.
I feel like having buttleness thrust upon you is grounds for a lawsuit.
It's a violation of the Geneva Conventions.
And you have 10 minutes.
Oh, no. I'm in a blaze. I'm starting my timer now. So, all right. Let me tell you about this book. Let me tell you some fun things about this book. It was published. The funnest fact is the date it was published, 1934.
That's a blast.
That pauses for applause or whatever you guys want to throw in there. Thanks to the dead silence. It's 350 pages long. It may be the only murder mystery built upon a structure of campanology. Do you guys know what campanology is?
Never heard of it.
I could make a joke, but just keep going.
Please do. Please do make a joke.
Something about camping.
Nope. Not a great joke. Shouldn't have done it. I regret telling you. Yep, this is on me. Campanology is the study of the history and technology of bells. So, bells.
What?
Bells.
Bells?
Like ding dong, ding dong, ding dong. Yeah, bells.
Okay.
Mostly
any
like...
any size?
Mostly like huge bells in church belfries and so forth. Okay. We'll get to that in a little bit. Just hang on to your bells. This book is part...
like a butler?
Like a butler. Yeah, butlers have bells. Great point. Hey, okay. I will give you a little taste right now. There is a butler in this story.
Fuck yes. I was going to be really disappointed if neither of you bought a murder mystery without a butler.
Absolutely a butler.
That's good.
I'm not going to say any more right now, but we'll get to the more about the butler in a bit. Okay. This book is part of Dorothy Sayers' highly regarded series of mysteries focused on Lord Peter Wimsey. He's this English gentleman who has like drives fast cars and eats fancy food and collects old books and is funny and handsome and also solves crimes and has PTSD. So
it's like Mr. Toad, if he solved crimes and had PTSD.
It's much
no,
better.
Mr. Toad created crimes. He fucking stole like 20 cars.
He was addicted to automobiles.
Addiction. What a great episode that is. Hey folks, if you haven't listened to that episode, go listen to it. It's incredible.
It's a book about a talking toad that steals cars to the point that he goes to prison. And it's a children's book.
I should have just
gone
with that. That's a really good pitch for that book. A talking toad who steals cars and goes to prison for it. Okay, I'm gonna tell you more about this book, though.
Ribbit, bitch.
I don't know what that means.
Ribbit.
This book is not just a murder story. It's also got stolen emeralds and bigamy. It has been made into a 4-part BBC miniseries, which is quite good. Let me tell you a little bit about the author, who is a great, great author. This is Dorothy Sayers. She participated in a literary coterie with a bunch of folks, but the best known are C.S. Lewis, who wrote the Narnia books, and our old friend J.R.R. Tolkien. She was a contemporary and friend of Lewis and Tolkien. This literary coterie was called the Inklings, and they met in a bar.
Did they name themselves the Inklings? Because that's a little too clever for the likes of C.S. Lewis, J.R.R. Tolkien.
No, that's what they were called, the Inklings. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep, that's great.
It's pretty good.
And this reminds me, I think it's time for a Hobbit fact. Since we got to Tolkien. I mentioned this literary coterie. They would read their books to each other, and Tolkien first read The Lord of the Rings to the Inklings and got some feedback on it there, some positive, some negative. And Tolkien had this friendship with C.S. Lewis, who is another one of the Inklings, as I mentioned. And it is speculated that Tolkien wrote the character of Treebeard the Ent in the Lord of the Rings to sound like C.S. Lewis. So he modeled the way this character talked off of the kind of booming voice of C.S. Lewis. So there you are. Hobbit fact for the day.
I feel like that's offensive.
Wait, why? No, Treebeard is awesome.
I've seen the films for Treebeard. Like, is the speech pattern the same? Like this, like long, slow, arduous?
Absolutely. Yes.
Okay. Well, that's a book.
Booming.
Yeah. It's like booming. Two words per page.
And speak very slowly.
Okay, more about Dorothy Sayers, because I got a lot to say about this book and I don't want to waste time. She wrote a bunch of stuff. She wrote plays and poetry and translated stuff. She was best known for these mystery novels, these Lord Peter Wimsey novels. But she actually thought that she did a translation of the late medieval poem, The Divine Comedy. And she thought her translation of that was her best work. We were talking earlier about literary stuff. And this book was criticized not for being too lowbrow, not for being not literary enough, but because it was too literary. People read this book, critics read this book, and they were like, it is too highfalutin. It's not fun enough. She should stick to mystery stuff. And to them, they thought mystery stuff had to be lowbrow, had to be pulpy, which I guess
that was my question.
It's some people still believe this, I guess. It's like, and I think there's like
some savages like me.
Well, I don't know. There's a long tradition of pulp mystery fiction, so it's understandable. I think books like this, and maybe books like Drive Your Bones of the Plow, Bones of the Bed.
Good.
Is,
yep. Perfect.
Thank you.
I love that.
You got it.
I think these books kind of demonstrate that the form can be literary, but you know, it's not always literary. So I'm not saying you're a Philistine. I'm just saying this book kind of proves you wrong, Nick. Other critics dislike the way the book ends. And I will say right now, it is a...
Well, it just seems like it's a murder mystery. If you don't like the way it ends, it's just like, that's like a lame criticism. I don't like Knives Out because it's stupid.
This week's special guest is Knives Out.
People,
I don't like Knives Out because it's stupid and they rely too much on a cast of 37 named characters to distract you from a shitty script and story narrative. Not the way it ends. I think the way it ends is fine.
I think this episode, the winner is going to be Nick and the loser is going to be Knives Out.
It's fine. It's a fine movie. I think it's fine.
Okay. I will say this. So there are some critics who don't like it because it's too literary and they're foolish.
Knives Out?
No. In my book, Nine Tailors.
Oh, okay.
Other critics dislike this book because they think the solution is implausible. But scientists have confirmed that the cause of death in the story can, in fact, cause death. So they're full of crap and science wins.
Okay.
Is it an undiscovered poison or it's an appliance which will need a long scientific explanation at the end?
No. All right. I'm not going to tell you guys what it is. I'm not going to. One of the things that Sayers does really, really, really well is she gives you all the information, but she doesn't do it in such a way that it seems like she's giving you information. So you look back and you're like, oh yeah, heck, it was there all along. I think it'd be really, really hard for someone to do that annoying thing where they open the book or they start watching the movie and they're like, oh, it's clearly this. Because there's like layers of mystery in this story. Like I haven't gotten to the longer plot yet, but there's like an identity, a mistaken identity issue. And like, that's part of this. And there's stolen emeralds and that's part of it. And she just like kind of like sows these seeds all throughout the, like from the very first page, like there's foreshadowing. So you get to the end and you're like, oh, it just clicks. And that's one of the reasons I like this book so much. And it's honestly kind of a rereadable mystery novel, which is weird. But like, she does such a good job, like masterfully, like dropping little things in. You read it the first time and you're like, oh, heck yeah, that's an amazing story. I got invested in the characters and the journey was amazing and the climax is incredible. And now I know the brilliant solution. And then you read it again and you're like, oh, I see what she did there. Oh, I see what she did there. And then you read it the third time, honestly.
Every murder. Okay. Now this is out of control.
No, seriously.
How many times are you reading this book?
Well, I'm going to say I've read the book three times. I've seen the miniseries a couple of times. So the third, like this time when I reread the book most recently, I was still picking up new stuff, which I think is kind of great.
That's awesome.
Especially for a mystery novel, which we think of as like disposable. Like you throw these things away.
But isn't that every murder mystery? No. I mean, there's clues throughout. No. Well, isn't that every good murder mystery? Like, there's clues from the beginning. That's the whole point of it.
I would say so, but I've recently been kind of on an Agatha Christie kick, and like Murder on the Orient Express is a very well-known Agatha Christie novel, and like once you know what happens at the end of that story, you're not like, ugh.
It's a blueprint, right?
I'm not going to pick it up again.
Right.
This amateur sleuth, Lord Peter Wimsey, I've mentioned him already. He's rich and handsome and funny and clever and stuff. He's great. Whatever. And she writes a bunch of books with him in the center. And some of them he kind of like stays in London. Some of them one of them really good when he goes up to Scotland. Another one he's in Yorkshire. In this book, he ends up in East Anglia, which is a part of England, which is kind of remote and marshy and very countrified. It's also really, really old. So like all those old, like King Arthur and his knights, those stories, like some of them take place in this area. There's a ton of history. This area, and I'm emphasizing this because this is a novel about mood. This is a novel which is like relies on its mood and the vibe of the whole surrounding area, the people there. It's kind of honestly like the American South in terms of like that gothic, a lot of history, a lot of green growing things, a lot of swamps. Lord Peter gets stranded in this little village called Fenchurch St. Paul, a little village.
Did you say Lord Peter?
Yeah,
Lord Peter Wimsey.
Lord Peter Wimsey. Yeah, he's a lord.
He's a lord. What? Yeah. How do you become a lord?
You get borned into it. Kind of like butlers, it's a born thing.
Butlers, okay. Wizards, and lords.
Okay, do you think there's a school, like a Hogwarts-type school for lords?
Maybe we could do like a book where we each write a chapter about a lord.
You're
like
just
a Sith lord.
Oh, wait.
Okay,
what?
Joe will do Sith. I'll do Christian. And Ian can do...
I'll do the singer. I'll do the singer named Lord. That would be kind of cool.
Oh, that's good. L-O-U-R-D-E.
Yep. There it is.
Lorde, yes.
I She's not it. A royal.
Oh, well,
ruined it. He ruined it.
Can I talk about my book, please?
No.
Okay, yes. So this village, Fenchurch St. Paul, is surrounded by fens, swamps, flat, swampy, kind of mucky ground. So Lord Peter gets stranded there. He talks to the locals. He learns about kind of like what's going on in the town. It's a pretty sleepy town. They have a problem. They're going to ring the changes on their church bells for New Year's Eve. And one of the people who's supposed to help, they need 9 people to do it. And one of the people who's supposed to help is sick. And so he steps in to help ring the changes on these church bells for New Year's Eve. One of the Ten Commandments should have been, the 11th commandment should have been, like, your detective needs to know most of the things that they run into. So like Lord Peter just happens to know about change ringing. So he helps him ring the changes in the New Year, and then he leaves. His car gets fixed. He's fine. The story then jumps forward 4 months to Easter, and an unidentifiable body, which has been kind of like hacked up around the face so you can't see who it is, and decomposing, has been dug up in someone else's grave. So you already have this unknown identity, I guess. That's like the first mystery. Who is this person? And also kind of like, why is he dead? And he's also wearing French underpants. He seems like maybe he's a laborer, but he's also wearing
really fancy
French clothes, and it's very confusing. What the heck is going on? And so I'm not going to tell you anything more about what happens in the novel. I'll just say that the rest of the novel involves him, Lord Peter, trying to figure out who this guy was and how he died and who killed him.
Whoa, you said he died?
No, yeah. How the guy died. How the guy with the French underpants died.
Yeah.
All right, I'm looking up French underpants.
Well,
oh boy.
It's just a lot of
Tarantino mode for that one.
Is Lord Peter Wimsey, is he like a Sherlock Holmes? Like, is he like a serial detective? So like, are there a lot of Lord Peter Wimsey novels in which he solves the mystery?
Yes, right. A lot of novels, a lot of short stories. And some of them are longer, some of them are shorter, but of the novels. But they're all really good. I love these novels. They're for reasons I can talk about later, they're a lot of fun. And I'm not going to spoil it. But the novel takes you right up until the very last page before it unveils the solution. And oh my goodness, it is so worth it. Like, we're talking about tropes, we're talking about conventions. A lot of the stuff you've seen before, I can say I've read fairly widely. I would say I'm pretty well read in mystery stories. I have never come across a solution quite like this. It's just, oh my goodness. I opened this up to start preparing and I was getting goosebumps as I was reading that last little bit. When you have a bunch of bells that have different pitches, that have different, make different notes, you can ring them like one after another. So it goes like, ner, 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 ner.
Oh, cool. Yeah, sure.
Or you can make them do like, you can do different intervals and you can ring them in such a way that the intervals repeat in this very complex changing pattern where things from before come kind of get recycled back into the rhythm. Mm, and there are these,
I know where this is going,
overlapping cycles.
Can I guess?
Please.
Okay, so they play some sort of rhythm in this bell song and then the entire book actually plays along with that rhythm.
Well, kind of. I would say more the idea. It's not like you can read it to the rhythm of the bells, but it's more the idea of like things from the past come back. And just when you think a detail or a fact is kind of gone, like that right. cycle has been passed, that pattern is not happening anymore. It crops back up and has a different sense to it. And so what Sayers does here in the story is she takes a fairly limited amount of evidence and she like really turns it over and you discover like actually how rich it is. So just like there are 9 bells in the tower in Fenchurch St. Paul, and these are the 9 tailors of the title. The 9 tailors are the 9 bells in the tower, and each mm-hmm. of them has a funky name. And it's the same way. There are like limited number of bells, limited number of tones. The artistry is how you use them and how you put them together. And so the solution to this mystery is the way that Lord Peter is able to kind of like put all of the limited information he has together to produce truth out of it. And
yeah,
by building, and she builds, so she clearly like did her research on this and she builds the novel around this motif of things coming back and things being recycled and things being revisited. And you get to the end and you have a sense, you know, all this, you know, all these people very well, you know, all this information, this data, this evidence, and it works. If you listen to a piece of classical music, a lot of times like there's a motif, a musical theme, which is introduced early, and then it kind of recycles in various forms throughout the course of the piece, and the piece kind of develops it. You can get this in jazz too, honestly. The piece develops it, plays with it, kind of pushes it here and
builds
there.
Builds it, makes it a little bigger. Yeah, absolutely.
And this becomes kind of a structure for the whole thing and a recurring. So I would say a theme, like a musical theme. She's a little bit cute about it. She names her chapters kind of along these lines, but there's also like connected to terminology from change ringing. But it's also a sense that if you knew change ringing, you would totally understand like the cleverness of it. So you kind of get the sense that the more you know about this, the richer it'll be. So that's all I have to say about this book. Guys, it's a great book. You should read it. It's really just artfully done. The bells are central. That's all I'm going to say. Oh, and there's a butler. And the butler, here we go. This is how it'll end. This is how it'll end. You guys ready for this?
He did it. Here comes a spoiler. Nick, nope. He's going to spoil it.
Not going to spoil
it. Okay, I'm ready.
The butler didn't do it.
Oh.
Hey, that's a spoiler too.
No, hear me out. The butler didn't do it. The butler had it done. And that's not a spoiler.
That's got to be a spoiler.
It's not.
Nick's very spoiler sensitive.
I am going to cut that. That made me so upset. You were so close, Ian. You just had to tease it.
Nope.
You just had to like just
the
dance on that line.
The butler had
it done.
Gotta fuck with him a little bit on the spoilers.
It's not a spoiler.
How you fucking roll, isn't it?
It's not a spoiler.
Oh, I'm going to tell him it's not a spoiler, but it's going to sound like a spoiler.
Yeah, that's the brilliance of what I do, Nick. I say things that sound like spoilers, but in fact are more or less complete nonsense.
You sicko. Wow. These both sound good. Ian, yours does sound pretty compelling, but I think you just sold it a lot better than Joe. But I did say Joe was going to win, so congratulations, Joe. What are you going to send us off with?
Is there a twist now? Is this where the twist happens?
Oh, no. No, I don't. Nope. No twist.
All right.
Joe wins.
No twist.
So this... Wait. The mystery of this
is... That's the twist.
The mystery of this is it wasn't a mystery at all.
No mystery.
Yeah. You thought there was going to be a twist, and there isn't. So that's the twist.
The mystery, as it continues to be, is how Nick makes these decisions.
That is the mystery of the show. 15 seasons, 15 episodes, 16. When is this coming out?
Nailed it.
Yeah. We're at 15 today. All right. So, Nick, one thing I have to say is throughout my entire novel, there's a motif talking about motifs that we didn't get to so far. And the title, which is, of course, Drive Your Plow Over the Bones of the Dead, is this line lifted from a William Blake poem. And William Blake is this poet who shows up throughout the novel. Like, each chapter starts with a quote from a William Blake poetry. The main character translates William Blake into Polish in her free time, of course, trying to maintain like the meter and the rhythm. And William Blake is kind of an interesting guy. Ian, you know some fun facts about William Blake, I bet.
Yeah, he was involved in a free love movement. He designed and printed the copper plates and colored the copper plate printings for his poetry. And one time he punched a soldier and said, "Damn the king, soldiers are all slaves." And then he got in trouble for that. So
he's one of these poets who like just isn't particularly, he's well read enough, but in proportion to how important he's in, it's said that he's the least read body of poetry in the English language. And he's one of these guys who's hard to put into a genre. And I think that really appeals to Olga Tokarczuk. And as a result, Blake is omnipresent in this piece and really appears as a motif throughout. All right, Nick, I've got William Blake's probably most famous poem for you, and you might have heard it before. This is about the tiger.
Hey, can I jump in with one more fun fact?
Yes,
I'm just doing some research on this. Holy cow. Yeah. So Blake initially intended a lot of his poems to be sung. A bunch of people have tried to come up with tunes for these poems, including Duran Duran, who have a song called Tiger, Tiger.
No kidding. So I'm about to sing the Duran Duran song.
Please
Tiger,
do.
Tiger. I will be. Nick, one thing I think you'll like about this is Tiger here is spelled with a Y, T-Y-G-E-R.
We know how Nick loves misspellings.
All right. Tiger, Tiger, burning bright in the forest of the night. What immortal hand or eye could frame thy fearful symmetry? In what distant deeps or skies burnt the fire of thine eyes? On what wings dare he aspire? What the hand dare seize the fire? And what shoulder and what art could twist the sinews of thy heart? And when thy heart begin to beat, what dread hand and what dread feet? What the hammer, what the chain, and what furnace was thy brain? What the anvil, what dread grasp dare its deadly terrors clasp? When the stars threw down their spears and watered heaven with their tears, did he smile his work to see? Did he who made the lamb make thee? So tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forest of the night, what immortal hand or eye dare frame thy fearful symmetry? Do you think I should pronounce that symmetry?
I don't know. That's a weird one.